Good evening. All right, well, we're going to kind of continue on with our discussion from this morning. Thank you. And we're going to basically continue on with a discussion on some kind of primary apologetics information. One of the things that I want to make sure and bring across today is that just like this morning's session, this is very much an introduction. Hello. And she's excited. So this is very much an introduction. I don't expect you to walk away from this and have every possible answer that anybody's ever going to ask you regarding apologetics. But what I do want to do is I want to make sure that we kind of introduce some of these subjects. At the end of the session, I'm going to give you a list, if you will, of some of the regular resources that I use. But before we jump into this, I want to tell you a little story about how this really connected with me. I've enjoyed the subject of apologetics for a long time. As I mentioned in the first session, I was kind of a jerk when I was becoming a Christian, because I was very much of the mindset that there were no answers to the questions that I was asking. That there is absolutely, in my mind, there's absolutely no reason to believe that the Bible was the Word of God or that God even existed, and that if He did, He certainly wasn't the God of the Bible. And so I asked all kinds of questions. My wife can back me up on this. I was not fun to study with, I'm sure. Or maybe I was. I don't remember. From my perspective, I felt like I was winning all the time. But He kept coming back. And so we're here. So I've been interested in apologetics for a long time. And I had the opportunity to go to New Zealand. It was 2009, correct? 2008? 2009. And speak briefly at a family camp there on the Southern Island in Dunedin. And Dunedin is, it's a college town, and it's on the, as I mentioned, it's on the South Island, and they get people from all over the world, and primarily the Asian Pacific region, but a lot of Europeans that'll come into Otago University. So being a college town, we get to the assembly, and we're kind of talking about this rally we want to do to bring some college kids in and start talking to them. So how do you get college kids to show up at something? Food, right? You offer them food, okay? So this is something that they've done many, many times. And so I got a group of kids from, I can't remember the name of the university, but they're a Church of Christ, and I'm going to use that term very loosely, university. And they were there supposedly for mission trips. And so I figure, let's go down to the campus. We're going to walk around. We're going to talk to people about Christ. We're going to ask them questions. We're going to invite them to this sausage sizzle where we're going to make pizza at a sausage sizzle. I didn't get it. I still don't get it. But hey, people showed up. So we're walking around the campus and we're talking to people. And I ran into somebody from Montana, believe it or not, from Fort Peck. I'm like, that's a long way. Anyway, so we invite all these people. All these college kids, and so they, of course, flock like locusts to the church building for the food. And so one of the things that they would do is they wouldn't cook any of it until everybody got there. So it was an opportunity to talk to people while the food was cooking, and we did end up actually making a couple of pizzas too. But the whole point is that we had some time to interact with people, and there was this one guy, I was having a great conversation with him. He was older than a regular college student, probably, I don't know, he was probably 5 to 6 years older than most of the rest of the kids who had come. But real smart guy. I don't remember what his major was. But I was engaging him in conversation. I ended up talking to this guy for about 3.5 hours at this thing. And he was one of the last guys to leave. And so we're sitting at a table, and there was probably less than 25 of us originally. From the assembly, and then maybe another 15 or 20 college kids. But it was him and I, and then everybody else from the congregation who were left. And we were talking back and forth, and he was answering great questions about, you know, creation and about dinosaurs and man and the fossil record and evolution and all these great questions. And I'm having a great time, and I'm answering the questions. And I'm like, wow, that was a great conversation. I don't know whatever happened. But as the guy leaves, two things were told to me that I was floored by. Number one, this guy had been coming to every one of their things for like the past 2 years, but nobody would talk to him because he would ask hard questions. So for 2 years, this guy shows up and gets free food. And nobody would talk to him. Because the first couple of times he showed up, he would ask questions that they didn't know how to answer. That was number one. Blew me away. The other thing was that they had no idea that you could actually answer the questions. And that's really where it connected with me, that this kind of stuff is important. It's important to be able to answer some of those questions that you're going to get all the time. Because believe it or not, most people believe in evolution. I hope you don't, but most people do. It's something you're going to have to deal with, just as one example. So that's why I consider this stuff to be pretty important. So we're going to jump into a number of sections today. And like I said, we'll cover them in a certain amount. Really just going to introduce a few of the subjects. One of them is cosmology. It's basically the study of the origin and the general structure of the universe that's looking out around us. What in the cosmos leads us to believe that there's a God? The origins of life wasn't an accident. We weren't simply carried on the backs of crystals, which is silly. Didn't come from aliens, by the way. Dinosaurs and man, yeah, they, guess what? They coexisted. And actually, Mark had mentioned one of the things that has always been a great source of proof for us, right? The Paluxy Riverbed. He's backed away from it a little bit. And anyway, there's much more evidence. Also, we'll talk a little bit about the fossil record. Ever heard of the fossil record in terms of the geologic column? People always say that all the complex stuff is at the top and all the less complex stuff is at the bottom. And we have all this evidence of evolution over time, billions and millions of years. And oh, wait, maybe it's just trillions. We can't remember now. But it's been a long time. Ever hear of the fossil record and how it supports evolution? Guess what? It doesn't. And then lastly, I want to talk about the hydroplate theory. Originally, I was going to talk about specifically the hydroplate theory tonight. But Mr. Hartford, in his wisdom, recommended that I cover a few more subjects. So we're going to talk about a number of subjects tonight. But the hydroplate theory, how many of you have heard of the hydroplate theory? Oh, that's good. That's more than, well, you shouldn't raise your hand because I was counting. But that's more than I expected. What if you get an opportunity to talk to people about the authenticity of the scripture, what's one of the things that they bring up that they can't believe? Usually one of them is the parting of the Red Sea. I get that a lot. The other one's the flood. How do you explain the flood? I mean, there are a lot of theories out there, and only one of them, in my opinion, holds water. I need to think, but don't bump, right? But only really, I think the hydroplate theory is the best answer for answering the question of the flood. How did it happen? Where did the water come from? Where did it go? Do we see evidence for it, et cetera, et cetera? So we'll talk a little bit about those. I'm going to skip through or kind of buzz through a bunch of these, but again, this is just a point of introducing a lot of this. So when we talk about cosmology, it's basically looking at the universe around us. And the number one thing to remember regarding cosmology, and a lot of these other ones, but specifically when we look at cosmology, is the law of causality, right? The law of cause and effect. Let's break this down. It's really, really complex. Every effect has a cause. That's about it. I mean, there's more to it, of course, but every effect has a cause. So, and the cause of every effect has to be big enough to affect the effect. In other words, you can't have a small cause making a huge effect, at least in the physical realm. But and we'll talk a little bit more about it as we go here. So, the cause of the universe has three specific propositions. And this is really interesting when you stop and consider it. And again, we'll get to it in a little bit more detail. And then I'll probably skip through teleonomy because we've already talked quite a bit about that. But we want to talk about the law of cause and effect first. It is the most universal and most certain law in all of science. Science is based upon the understanding of the law of cause and effect. Because they look at an effect and they try to determine the cause. That's the basis of all scientific understanding and research. So every effect needs a cause, and every cause needs an effect. The cause is first, the effect is second. It's never vice versa. That's deep, powerful information there, right? Now, it's common sense, but believe me, you have to establish common sense more often than you'd think. And every material effect must have an adequate antecedent cause. That's basically whatever the cause is had to, or whatever the effect is, the cause had to exist before the effect. Does that make sense? Okay. So that's what the law of cause and effect is, in a very straightforward sense. And then we talk about what's called a contingent entity when we talk about cosmology. Contingent entities are basically things that cannot explain their own existence. So in other words, when we look at the universe and we look at the amazing amount of order and design in it and the mass in the universe and so on and so forth, guess what we don't find? We can't find a cause for the universe. It can't explain itself. We can't explain where the universe came from a scientific perspective. It's a contingent entity. It's one that does not account for its own creation. So it is dependent upon something outside of itself to explain its own existence. The universe is a contingent entity. And with that in mind, we have three propositions about how the cosmos, or how the everything that we see, has come about. So these three propositions, the first one is that the universe is eternal and has always existed. Okay? This is one that was, for a long, long time, was kind of the accepted answer to the universe, that it has always existed. Okay? And again, we'll talk about this in a little bit more detail as we move forward. The second is that it's not eternal, and that it created itself out of nothing. This is actually something that scientists believe. Okay? And then, of course, the third is that it's not eternal, and that it was created by something or someone anterior, which existed before it, and superior to itself. So these are the three main propositions when we talk about cosmology. So moving forward here, let's talk a little bit about an eternal universe question. In 2001, Time magazine announced to the world that astronomers had solved the biggest mystery in the cosmos. You know what that biggest mystery is? That the universe will end. I mean, it was a big deal. Now, and I'm going to say it again. Millions of your tax dollars was spent to come up with that answer. That the universe is going to end. Those tax dollars are being spent well, right? Okay. So, this particular question that they were trying to answer had plagued folks who study this. I can't remember the word, physicists, for a long, long time. And what they came up with is that they've identified the fact that the second law of thermodynamics actually means what it says. In other words, everything's winding down. So here's the conclusion that we can draw from this. There's a lot we can talk about. If the universe has an end, it had a definite beginning. In other words, it's not eternal. Okay? So with an ending, it can't be eternal. And so when we look at, this is one of the great things about the theory of evolution, is that so many of the folks who have been evolutionists for a long time have written a lot. And they'll say things that are really interesting, and you can use them in your defense of creation. He stated that Dr. Robert Jastrow, he's a leading cosmic evolutionary scientist and astronomer, he admitted that the universe does not explain how it first came to be. And any explanation of the creation of the universe and how it came about offered to date, they violate the laws of science. So what's the common answer for how the universe came about? Big Bang. Big Bang, in one way, shape, or form. It's been renamed like a half a dozen times, but it's all about the Big Bang, right? Dr. Robert Jastrow is basically saying that violates the laws of science in order to answer the question. So you can get into all kinds of things, and we'll talk about them, a few of them here in just a moment. So he also stated that evolutionists do their best to avoid the questions of the beginning and the end of the universe. They want to study a very narrow portion of the universe. And the things that honestly, the universe is amazing. It really is. And the more we learn, and the more the further out we're able to see, and the more we're able to magnify, it's beautiful. It's amazing. It's a testament to God's creative power, right? But they don't want to talk about the beginning or the end because they don't know the answers. Okay? And so he was also asked if there was anything from physics that explains how the universe came to be, how it first came to be. I have a universe in there an awful lot of times. There is nothing in science that explains how the universe first came to be. And this is, I mean, this guy's a leader in cosmic evolution. He's like, there's no way to explain it from looking at the universe itself. So the conclusion is that the universe itself is not eternal. That's the bottom line. So if the universe isn't eternal, then we can move on to the second one and ask about a self-created universe. So did the universe create itself out of nothing? February 2001, Scientific American magazine published an article titled The Big Bang, Wit or Wisdom? In the article, they made the statement that we no longer see a Big Bang as a solution to what caused the universe. This was 2001. So the reality is that most cosmologists for a long time had accepted that the Big Bang theory was dead. But you know what they did? They renamed it. And you know why they renamed it? Because they exhausted all the research dollars calling it Big Bang. They get more research dollars when they change the name to investigate this. It's exactly the same thing. It's just packaged a little differently. This has happened several times. So out of the original death of the Big Bang came what's called the inflationary model. It's the idea that the universe is, in fact, self-created. George Davis wrote, "No material thing can create itself, and such statement cannot be logically attached on the basis of any knowledge available to us." I love the fact that we pay these people so much money to come up with statements like this. Okay? No material thing can create itself. The inflationary model. There's all the evidence supporting it. Okay, just kidding. So basically what's happening is that evolutionists are suggesting that something came from nothing. That the universe actually created itself from nothing is the standard approach and theory behind where the universe came from. That it created itself out of nothing. Anybody familiar with G.K. Chesterton? Oh, I love this guy. If you haven't read him, you should. Here's his quote concerning evolution. He says, "It is absurd for the evolutionist to complain that it is unthinkable for an admittedly unthinkable God to make everything out of nothing and then pretend that it is more thinkable that nothing should turn itself into everything." You know what evolution is? It's actually a system of faith. And Phil Sutton and I were having a conversation about it afterwards, and you know what? Sometimes you're not going to be able to change people's faith. But if they're honest, hopefully you'll start to make some progress with them. So, conclusion to proposition number two is the universe did not create itself out of nothing. And here's the third one. A created universe means that it is not eternal, and the universe did not create itself out of nothing, and instead, there is a creator anterior and superior to the universe itself. So, the creator himself existed before it. He is the eternal, uncaused first cause. So remember when we talked about it in information theory and we talk about who trained God on how to use DNA and how to program all of that? It's the same essential argument here. In order for something to create something else, the creator has to be greater than the creation itself. Now I want you to stop and consider just how vast the universe is. I mean, it's mind-boggling, literally. And I have a whole bunch of slides on it that we'd normally cover, but the universe is massive. And it's pretty amazing. And we're just going to leave it at that, otherwise we'll never get done. So the creator is superior to the universe. The created cannot be superior to the creator. And the creator is of a different nature than that which it created. The universe is a finite, dependent creation unable to explain itself. You know, I've never done pottery. I'm not an artistic fellow in that regard. I can draw stick figures and flies. But think about the creative power that went into that, into creating the universe around us. And think about all of the aspects of creation that are absolutely amazing. And now think of that coming by out of itself. From matter that didn't exist, that exploded in space that didn't exist. It doesn't make any sense. Instead, we have a creator God that is different, that is above, and that is greater. So the universe was created by an eternal, superior creator. Okay? So that's the section on cosmology. I'm going to skip through a number of slides on teleonomy because we've already covered a lot of this. But I want to talk a little bit about what makes the Earth so special. And by the way, a lot of this information that I'm covering, you can sum up really well in a number of movies that are out there. Oh, and Mike, would you remind me later to correct myself on something that we talked about afterwards? Thanks. So what makes the Earth so special? Well, it's a pale blue dot, right? Earth is a very special planet. And despite what you hear in the news, it is amazingly finely tuned and finely placed in the universe, in the galaxy, in the solar system to create life, to sustain it. Excuse me, not to create it, but to sustain it. It has all the factors necessary for life. And if you break it down into really simple formats, the probability of finding another planet in the universe possessing only a few of the factors necessary for life, specifically plentiful liquid water, molten core, magnetic field, large moon, correct type of star, atmosphere, placement within the galaxy, correct distance from the sun, that's a few. That's only a few of the requirements for a planet to exist in order to support organic life. Just a few. You take all of those things, you do some math, you come up with this calculation. All right, all you math whizzes. Look at that. All right, explain that to me. I'm not going to, no. Okay, these are some of the factors necessary for creating life. And it's in a lovely scientific formula. And you do some math on it. And there's the numbers. Oh. So, you do all the math in that. You come up with a number that looks something like this. That means 1 in 10 to the 15th power of a planet existing in the universe that is capable of supporting life. Capable. Doesn't mean it has life. It means it's capable of. So, that's these factors that are necessary for life include 3 elemental truths. One of those elemental truths is that the basic laws of science, all fields, are the same everywhere in the universe. You know, we talked about this with intelligent design as well. It doesn't matter how far away you get, 2 plus 2 still equals 4. Okay? And all sorts of other things. The unchanging laws apply everywhere in the universe and at all times. And the factors necessary for life on Earth are the same factors that are necessary anywhere else. That's the bottom line of this, guys. So you'll often hear a lot about new possible planets. If you read beyond the first couple of sentences in those articles, they'll actually go on and talk about the things that they found in relationship to those planets for them to say that they think it could support life. You know the things that they'll say? They'll usually say things like it's in the right place in relationship to another planet or a star. And they'll usually say other things like, well, there's a possibility of an atmosphere. There's a possibility of an atmosphere. By the way, you know that you usually can't see other planets. All you can do is detect their location in space. Other planets outside of our solar system. We actually don't have any idea what other planets in our solar system actually look like. All those scientists, the renderings that you see in the news, they're all a guess. Because we can't actually see them. We detect them through radio telescopes, essentially. But anyway, if you read on in those articles, what you'll see is that they don't have all of the factors necessary for life. They'll have maybe 1 or 2. Maybe they're the right size. Maybe they're not a gas giant. Maybe they're within the right location within the solar system of itself. But usually that's about it. And they're not going to give you much more than that. So these factors that are necessary anywhere else in the universe help us to understand that the universe is finely tuned by the Creator. And this obvious design in the universe supports complex life points to an omnipotent Creator. There is a fantastic video that walks through this process, this understanding. It's called The Privileged Planet. There's also a book and a number of articles that are published around this same particular subject. If you have not seen them, I highly recommend you buy them. And actually, it's part of the intelligent design curriculum that's put out by Illustra Media. There's 3 movies. First one's called Darwin's Dilemma. The second one is Privileged Planet. And then the other one is Unlocking the Mysteries of Life. If you have never gotten those movies, buy them. Like, I'll even give you some time to put them in your Amazon cart. Seriously, these are fantastic resources. You watch them through a few times, and then you sit down and share them with somebody who has questions about the creation of the universe. it'll blow their minds because they've never heard this information. Great stuff. Very, very well presented. All right, so we're going to move on and talk a little bit about the origins of life as it relates to evolutionary theory. Evolutionary theory, it's a fun one. Lots of information out there to help understand it and refute it. But evolutionary theory relies upon billions of years and random chance. I can't remember the gentleman's name. He had a laptop and he was showing me the counter. What was your name? Mike. Mike has an application. I want you to all talk to him afterwards, and I want him to show you this. Okay? Random chance does not create new information, right? So we've talked about that in terms of intelligent design. When you engage somebody in a discussion like this, one of the things that you have to remember is that for something to evolve, it has to exist. Remember, we talked about that this morning. And remember that, because evolutionary theory presupposes creation. It's assuming that creation's already happened, because you can't evolve something that doesn't exist. Okay? And evolutionary theory cannot explain the origins of life. So when we talk about evolution, the basic philosophy of evolution is that everything in the universe came into existence through a random chance processes, and there's no supernatural involvement whatsoever. Anybody, I'm going to make a quick point here. Anybody ever heard of Michael Behe? He knows. He wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. Anybody ever heard of that? Have you read his book? You know what he leaves room for at the end of that book? Aliens. Not kidding. Michael Behe, the guy who comes up with the idea of irreducible complexities and publishes and writes about it, in the last portion of his updated book, he basically says that there's a possibility that we came from aliens. Wow. Yeah. Anyway, we'll move on. So, and the basic philosophy of evolution includes that the origin of the universe can be explained by time, chance, and continuing processes. In other words, it's often called uniformitarianism. And the things that we see happening today are the same things that have been happening since the beginning of time and creation, and they can explain where we all came from and how all of this changed. That's the basic philosophy of evolution. And of course, at the beginning aspects of evolution, it assumes that life originated from a single cell organism that came from non-living matter. They just make that assumption and move on. Okay? However, information for that life cannot come from non-living matter, as we talked about with information theory. So that's the basic standpoint and the very essential rebuttal. This is one of the reasons why we covered some of the things that we did in information theory. Because you're going to get people that are going to get into very specific items of evolution. There are six, Dr. Kent Hovind, you might know who he was, he used to be called Dr. Dino. I love the way that he put it. He defines basically six different kinds of evolution. Okay, there's cosmic evolution, chemical evolution, stellar and planetary evolution, organic evolution, macroevolution, and microevolution. Only one of these actually happens. You ever heard of squirrels? You know, little varmints that run up your tree? Apparently I've heard from people in Virginia that they taste good. Is that true? No? I don't know. Maybe it's Kentucky. I don't remember. Tastes like chicken. Only one of these actually happens. It's microevolution. It's change within kind. In other words, you'll have red squirrels and gray squirrels. Okay? You'll have Chihuahuas and you'll have St. Bernards. Still dogs, right? Okay, that's microevolution. Everything, none of the other ones of these have ever been shown to actually have occurred. So when we look at the definitions of evolution, to help frame this discussion, it's important for people to understand that when they say the word evolution, they're probably referencing, most of the time, organic evolution, and they don't even really understand what that is. Or macroevolution is kind of the same thing. It's changed from one kind to another. But Once evolution is defined in their mind as a naturally occurring beneficial change, that's the assumption that they make moving forward, because this is what they've been told. You know, there's a thing called genetic entropy. Ever heard of genetic entropy? It basically means that as a human race, it's kind of sad, our genetic material is breaking down, and every generation has more and more harmful changes to the genetic code. It's the second law of thermodynamics at work. And it's a natural occurring phenomenon of science, and there's nothing we can do to change it. We are moving to a less organized state every generation. We're not improving in our complexities. Okay? So, when we talk about these things, one of the things that's important for us to understand is that none of us was there. We don't know what the beginning looked like, whether we're evolutionists or whether we're Christians, because none of us was there. So, when we talk about this from this perspective, our discussion must be based upon an assumption, a hypothesis, or a theory. In other words, because none of us were there, we're going to have to make guesses about how the universe was created, how life first came to be. So when we look at this, we want to define a couple of things. An assumption is something that's taken for granted, and it is a legitimate starting point for an investigation in a lot of cases. Joey Starkey's here. I'm sure that you make assumptions when you're investigating in a case. It's a logical place to start, because if you don't have an assumption, you don't know what to look for, right? So assumptions are a logical place to start. Hypotheses are educated guesses or tentative assumptions. They have a little bit more strength than an assumption. And then finally, of course, we have theories, which are plausible general principles that are supported by documented facts. You know what a fact is? It's an actual occurrence, right? Okay, so we talked about a number of these things. Here's the thing. You will often hear organic evolution described as a fact. It is not. It is still just a theory, and that is all it ever can be, because it cannot explain the origins. Okay? So, evolution is based upon non-provable assumptions. Okay? So, there's two primary ones. The first one is that spontaneous generation must have occurred. Spontaneous generation is life from non-living matter. It's going to assume that it must have occurred. Right? In order for something to evolve, it must exist. And the second is that it only occurred once. There's all kinds of neat stuff we can talk about in that, but we don't have time. So, did you know that Christianity, when we talk about creation, that God created the heavens and the earth, that we're also making a non-provable assumption? Because guess what? None of us was there. We cannot go back and prove from science that God created the universe. We can prove it through the scripture, but we can't prove it scientifically that God created the universe. We're also making non-provable assumptions. But here's the difference. Have you ever talked to an evolutionist that said that? That this is the first thing that they're going to bring up? Oh, by the way, all the thing I'm going to tell you is based upon two non-provable assumptions? I haven't. Because most of the time they don't want to bring it up. But that's exactly where we're starting from. We're starting from the perspective that God did, in fact, create the universe and all things in it. Okay, and that we can't prove it from a scientific perspective. So, we're going to jump forward a whole bunch in this, but let's talk a little bit about the what you need for a protein molecule to form by chance. Okay, proteins are essential to life. Okay, if you don't have proteins, you die. Okay, your cells can't reproduce, you're dead. Okay, proteins are absolutely essential to life. First, you have to have the right bonds between amino acids. The second is you have to have only left-handed versions. And then third is that amino acids must link up like letters in a sentence. There's that syntax that we are talking about in apobetics that we're talking about in information theory. That's how it relates. And of course, the probability of a short functional protein being randomly created, it's 1 in 10, you know, no. It's one chance in 100,000 trillion, 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 trillion. I think I got them all. Now, more simply put, if you want it more simply, is 1 in 10 to the 125th, which is a 10 followed by 125 zeros. Proteins are the absolute minimum building blocks of life. That's the probability of one random protein being created by chance without intelligence. I'm sorry, those aren't even good for lottery odds. I mean, you're going to get struck by lightning many, many, many times before that ever happens. Okay? So, how many proteins are necessary for a minimally complex cell to exist? Anybody have any idea? Just off the top of your head. I'll give you an answer. I'll give you a range. It's between 1 and 1,000. How many proteins are necessary for a very simple cell? Yeah, exactly. Very good. Between 300 and 500 protein molecules are needed to create a minimally complex cell. I'm not going to do the math for you, but that number got much larger for one minimally complex cell to exist. Okay? You know what chance becomes? It's the naturalistic miracle. This is where the faith of evolution is really revealed. That there has to be some sort of natural miracle for stuff to happen in order for life to exist. And actually, there's several writers that's the conclusions that they essentially arrive at. And that's one of the reasons why they say that spontaneous generation, not only did it have to happen, but it can only happen once. Because they understand the chance behind it, the immense chance behind it. So, is organic evolution a fact? No. Organic evolution is invalid and cannot be a fact. There's a lot that we would cover, a lot more information on this. A lot of this information comes from the mystery, Unlocking the Mysteries of Life. There's also another one that's called Unlocking the Mysteries of Life Origins. Those two videos, if you sit down and you watch those, they're a fantastic introduction to this material. They'll help you understand it. They give you pictures to follow. They'll blow your mind with the complexity and the detail that's in them. Okay? So there's a lot that you can cover in these. I have a whole bunch more on organic evolution. What time am I done? Top of the hour? Somebody's not. Yes, I guess it is. Okay, top of the hour. So I've got a few more minutes. Let's keep moving forward here, and then I'll talk about a couple of other things. So let me jump out of this real quick. Oh, well, I guess we're going to completely jump out of that. So I want to move on. I do want to talk about a little bit about the hydroplate theory. A lot of the rest of the stuff that we would talk about relate to some of the other subjects of like dinosaurs and man, comparative embryology, the fossil record. We just don't have time to talk a lot about that. But I do want to jump down to the hydroplate theory discussion. There's several great books, that you can pick up regarding a lot of the other subjects that we've talked about. A lot of other movies that are out there as well. I mentioned one of them earlier. It was called Darwin's Dilemma. That's a great one that deals with the Cambrian explosion. You ever heard of the Cambrian explosion? That's where basically all life forms came into existence all at once in the fossil record. Huh. Sounds like creation to me, but nope. That's just random chance. Okay. All right. The hydroplate theory. This particular section is one that you can spend a lot of time on. I highly recommend that you pick up one of these. The name of this book is called, are you ready for this? In the Beginning, Compelling Evidence for Creation in the Flood. Books are about, I think they're about $30 to $40. This is a textbook. This actually teaches you everything you need to know about how to answer the questions involved in the flood. This book, by the way, all of the information in it, all the slides, all the notes, all the illustrations, all the research, everything is available for free on his website, on Dr. Brown's website. I've actually talked to Dr. Brown when I put this class together the first time a number of years ago. Super nice guy. I think he may have passed away by now because he was an older fellow then. Is he? Okay, thanks. But he's old now. But super, super nice guy. Very interesting to talk to. Very warm and welcoming. Great book. The long and the short of it is that Dr. Brown has gone through a tremendous amount of research to help explain the presence of the flood. It was developed about 35 years ago with 35 years of study by Dr. Brown, who is a PhD in mechanical engineering. Okay, the hydroplate theory explains, with overwhelming evidence, Earth's defining geological event, a catastrophic worldwide flood. Okay, so there's a lot of information that you can get out of this. Remember his website; it is creationscience.com. So you can get all of this. You can download the book. You can look at every piece of it on creationscience.com. It's a great book. Okay, If you can, pick up a copy because I don't think they're in print anymore. They're working on the 9th volume. All right. So the hydroplate theory is based upon some new evidence. And when we say new, we mean within the last 50 years or so, indicating a worldwide flood in which the waters came from under the Earth's crust. Sounds hard to believe, doesn't it? Because most of you probably think about it from the perspective of a canopy theory, right? And that's probably what most of you have for a perspective of where the flood came from. However, there's several problems with that. I don't have time to go into all the problems, but in Dr. Brown's book, the first chapter, just to give you an example, it's about 40 pages long. He's got 48 pages of notes to back up all the things that he said in the first chapter. You can really do deep dives into this stuff, and his information is fantastic. So when we look at the Bible, the description of the flood is in Genesis chapters 6 through 9. And one of the things that it says is in chapter 7, it says, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were opened." So in the hydroplate theory, the evidence that is presented here, that's found and that's discussed and heavily researched, helps to answer a lot of the unexplained mysteries that we see on the earth today. Okay? The Grand Canyon is one fantastic example. When you start to put the information together and you look at the Grand Canyon and how it came about, this theory answers that question. A number of other things that are difficult things to answer, like varying magnetic shifts on the ocean floor. The ocean trenches, where did they come from? Why is it that all the mountain ranges seem to run parallel to ocean ridges? Why is that? Okay? Hydroplate theory answers a lot of that. So, in essence, the flood was an amazingly powerful event. We're talking something that the world has never seen before and will never see again. Exceeded 30 trillion hydrogen bombs. He didn't just come up with that number, by the way. He actually shows you the math and how he came up with that number. And you can test it and look at it, but he has done a tremendous amount of work research to help explain this. So the hydroplate theory basically works on the premise that the continents were on plates as the flood happened. And we'll skip forward in a couple of things and wrap this up. So number one thing to remember about when we're evaluating a theory, and specifically about the flood, is just like initial creation, we can't repeat it. And so we're going to have to make assumptions about the pre-flood conditions and explain the flood and how it happened. So there are several assumptions that we make about the hydroplate theory. And this is the one that it's really based on. And that's that half the water now in the oceans was once in interconnected chambers about 10 miles below the Earth's surface. So excluding the extensive solid structure of these chambers, which are called pillars, the subterranean water was like a thin spherical shell averaging about 3/4 of a mile in thickness. Above the subterranean water was a granite crust. Beneath the water was a layer of basaltic rock. Here's a diagram. Okay. Let me do a couple of things here. I'm going to need about 5 more minutes just to be able to finish this out. Okay. One of the things that was discovered to help answer the question of the flood is called the Mohorovicic discontinuity. For short, it's called the MOHO, for obvious reasons. But the Mohorovicic or the MOHO, the Mohorovicic discontinuity is that there is subterranean water that's trapped under the crust of the earth currently. They discovered it by looking at the way that seismic waves travel down through the crust. And then as they would travel down through the crust, they would actually speed up underneath the crust before they would exit out the other direction. Okay, so this led them to the discovery of the Mohorovicic layer. It's a subterranean water chamber that forms a very thin spherical shell that's, again, about 3/4 of a mile thickness. There are 4 primary phases in the hydroplate theory. Give you a picture of the first one here. It's called the rupture. Now, the reason why it ruptured, it's dealt with what's called tidal pumping in supercritical water, but we're not going to get into that. So the 4 primary phases of the hydroplate theory are the rupture, the flood, continental drift, and recovery. Through these 4 phases, we can explain all those phenomena that I listed on the slide a little while ago, this helps to explain how all of those things came about. Okay? Number one, increasing pressure stretched the crust before the rupture. The crustal rock, it reached a failure point and a crack formed and grew at 3 miles per second. Okay, I'll keep moving. I don't want to get off track. Okay, so the crack eventually penetrates that subterranean chamber. So yeah, anybody ever done taking a balloon and you wrap it in paper mache? Okay, get the basic idea. Now what happens if you put more air in that balloon? That harder crust. You can put a lot more air in that balloon, but eventually that crust is going to break. And it's going to break fast. That's essentially what happened in the rupture phase. When the crack finally penetrates this subterranean chamber, this crack moves at 3 miles per second around the Earth, and it circles the entire globe in about 2 hours. Okay? And then it forms, when it meets up with itself, and then most of that initial stress is relieved. Okay? Well, during that process, the water underneath the crust of the Earth that there are still remnants of today is being released, eventually forming the mid-Atlantic ridges or the mid-oceanic ridges. Those are illustrated there on the map. Here's another idea. Basically, what happens is that as that rupture happened and goes around the Earth, it's kind of like the seam of a baseball. It goes all the way around the Earth. If you have Google Earth, it actually does a really good job of showing a lot of the oceanic trenches. And just follow it. Just grab Google Earth, zoom out, go to the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, find the ridge, and follow it all the way around the Earth. Okay? And this will start to make a lot more sense. So during this rupture, the subterranean pressure at the rupture suddenly dropped to near atmospheric pressure. This is due to what's called supercritical water. And I don't have a ton of time to explain it, but supercritical water is basically water that is under such intense pressure and heat that it cannot boil. But when the pressure is released, the heat is dissipated almost immediately due to the higher amount of surface area to volume. Okay? And it cools almost like that. Just do some research. Just go on YouTube and look for supercritical water experiments. It's really pretty cool. But basically, what happens is all this water that's under the Earth, because of tidal pumping, it's under extreme friction and heat. It heats up to the point where the crust eventually bursts, and in a very short amount of time, all that pressure is released, and the crust then forms a 10-mile deep slit all the way around the Earth. Okay. All along that ridge, a fountain of water jetted far into and above the atmosphere. You want to know where the ice age came from? Because guess what? We have had an ice age. The ice age came from the water that came from under the Earth. And it's, again, not just some pie-in-the-sky assumption that he makes. He actually proves it. Okay? A lot of that water fragmented and fell as rain great distances away. It would have been one impressive sight. Okay? There's, again, that kind of idea of what it looks like. Now, phase two is that each side of the rupture was about 10 miles high. The cliffs, as the water is coming out, it eventually erodes all of this. And to speed this up a little bit, all this erosion that's happening floods out over the surface of the Earth, and then eventually the Earth gets to a point where the water has now covered the surface of the Earth. Okay? And then, looking at those mid-Atlantic ridges or the mid-oceanic ridges, about 35% of the sediment ejected was basalt from the chamber floor. So there's a ton of material, many tons obviously of material, that's been deposited. Waters were thick and muddy. It stirs up the animals, the plants, all of this, and it begins the process of fossilization. And then over the course of time, liquefaction sorts sediments, animals, plants into horizontal layers. Liquefaction is an amazing phenomenon. A quick and easy way to remember liquefaction, it's quicksand, but in a much larger scale. And guess what? When you take organisms, and they do tests to prove this, you take some critters and you put it in a bucket. Well, a bucket's probably not the right word. But you put it in a container full of soil, of rocks and small sediments and grains, and you put maybe a dead chicken in there and a fish and some really simple critters, and you mix it up through liquefaction, through vibration, guess what? Those layers of the dirt will form nice, clean striations, nice, clean layers, and then the animals will sort in the order that we find them in the fossil record. Huh. So you mean the fossil record doesn't prove evolution? Nope. Okay. Wow. Phases 3 and 4. I'm just going to jump to the end. A couple of quick things here. One of the questions you'll always get, where did the water come from and where did it go? Water came from under the surface of the earth. This illustration is a two-scale representation of the volume of water currently on the earth and the volume of air currently in our atmosphere. So where'd all the water go? It's right there. Okay. A lot more we can talk about in that. Okay. Next phase would be the one where eventually, because of the tectonic stresses, the plates essentially slide away from each other. Okay, so as the plates slide away from each other on one side of the earth, what happens on the other side? So if they slide away at the Atlantic side, you are on a globe, you have some some lubricated plates that are sitting on top of another sphere. As they slide away from each other, what's going to happen on the other side of the earth? They're eventually going to hit something. They're going to run into each other. Remember that split went all the way around the earth like a baseball, approximately 800 miles wide. And eventually those plates are going to slam into each other. And what are those plates going to do when they hit each other? They're going to push up mountains. So if you look at, for instance, the Rocky Mountains, it's where two plates collided. And they run, awful parallel to the mid-oceanic ridge in the Pacific. If you look at the Pacific Ocean, by the way, did you know that the sea floor of the Pacific Ocean is continental crust? Which means at one point it was above water. You know, the Atlantic floor is not. So this helps to explain some of that phenomena. And then, of course, the last phase is recovery. That's essentially where we are right now. Recovery is the Earth's kind of resettling back into its norm. By the way, we shouldn't be surprised that the temperatures continue to rise because we're returning back to a state of equilibrium. Okay, I've covered a ton of information. The only other thing I want to mention is a couple of other videos. One of them is called Evolution's Achilles Heels. This one is fantastic. It is exceptionally well done, but you have to understand it before you show it to somebody else. And the reason I say that is because Evolution's Achilles Heels is a very complex explanation of a lot of the issues with evolution. Don't show that to somebody without watching it first. Know your audience. If you don't think that the person that you're dealing with is going to be able to understand some of those concepts, start with Unlocking the Mysteries of Life and the Origins video in that same regard. Okay, so that's the other one I wanted to mention. Pick up a book if you can. I'm not selling them. I don't have any of them. I only have my two copies. And then the correction I need to make. You ever tell a joke and then you screw up the punchline? Yeah, I screwed up the punchline. Thanks, Mike, for reminding me. There's a number of excellent videos out if you've ever heard of Patterns of Evidence. You ever heard of those movies? Explaining the Exodus is the first one. He does a fantastic job of correcting the errant timeline that we use because we base all of our historical timelines on the Egyptian chronology, and it's wrong. But he does a great job of correcting it. He also writes another one. What's it called, Mike?
The Moses Controversy.
It wasn't Moses that came up with language first, it was Joseph. I'm sorry. And what's that? Yes, the alphabet. Did I say language? I'm done. So, he came up with the alphabet first. Moses was the one who recorded it for us, but Joseph is the one who created it, and I screwed up the punchline on that one. So, all right, I'm done. I'm sure you guys are done too. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Jared.
So just want to dovetail off something he said. You know, we talked about, you know, proof the Bible is the Word of God in the panel discussion, maybe rewriting a couple, you know, adding a couple of things to that. One of the things I do in the beginning section there, if somebody is scientifically based, I will show that video of evolution's Achilles heels to them because it is pretty amazing. There's a particularly sassy Kiwi biochemist on there that does a really good job of eviscerating the by chance chemical evolution of the human cell or of any cell. It does a particularly great job. If somebody is not scientifically based, one of the ones that I found great success with,